Lawmakers debate new gun laws in Tallahassee and a proposal to dramatically change Florida's education standards. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We're going to hear about a couple gun bills that would allow more guns in places like churches and public meetings. Also, Governor DeSantis promised to get rid of the Common Core standards. His new plan is called the BEST standards. What are they and how will they change the way your child learns? And South Florida is still battling the opioid addiction crisis. We spoke with a National Geographic reporter who looked at how the medical industry is rethinking pain management, including using virtual reality. Finally,
there are so many stories that our parents didn't share with us. So a lot of my Cuban history I've gotten from books or documentaries.
A play at the Colony Theater looks at the politics within a Cuban family. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Should you be allowed to bring a gun to your place of worship? This question is currently being debated in Tallahassee as the legislative session is well underway. It's one of several bills that have been filed that expand the number of public places that you could bring concealed weapons. Joining us now from Tallahassee is Jim Saunders with the News Service of Florida, who's been following these bills. Jim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So the Florida legislature, again, tackling gun bills this year. One of them allows concealed weapons owners to carry on the grounds of a religious institution. What's the argument by lawmakers to allow guns in churches?
Well, this issue's been around for a few years, but it's gained some additional attention this year. I think because of, there were some pretty high-profile church shootings in Texas. There was the synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh. And I think that there are, people looking at religious institutions being vulnerable to attacks. So it is getting some debate here in the House, and it's passed through one committee at this point and had some Democratic support as well. Usually these bills kind of break down along partisan lines, but that one got a little bit of a Democratic support as well.
And you said that, it's in a committee right now. Senate version, is there a Senate version of this right now?
Well, the Senate hasn't moved on it at all. Really, the tale of guns right now in Tallahassee is that the Senate and House are going in different directions. The Senate's been talking about possibly some gun control types of measures or changes, while the House which generally is a more conservative body, it's looking at issues that could expand some gun rights, including this church issue. Just to kind of clarify, there's really nothing in law that prevents people from bringing guns to churches at this point. But the issue is that a lot of churches share and synagogues share property with schools, and it is illegal to bring guns on the grounds of schools. So any of these churches that are religious institutions that are on school property, that's where guns are not allowed. That's what this bill would address, would allow those institutions to allow people to carry concealed weapons in those circumstances. Essentially, it's a school property issue,
right?
Mostly.
Right.
So it goes down to preschools too. It's not just what we may think of as K-12 schools or something like that.
We've heard from synagogues and churches that have armed security guards on the premises. So this legislation basically, though, is just opening it up for regular folks to bring if they have concealed weapons permits.
Right. It would allow the leaders of the church or synagogue to determine whether people could carry concealed weapons on their property. So it wouldn't just throw open the doors completely for somebody going to church on Sunday to be carrying weapons. But it would allow if the churches decide they want to allow it, then that would be acceptable under this bill.
Have you heard from, and I don't know if there are any church leaders in Tallahassee who've been speaking about this one way or the other?
The only one that I've seen so far was at a House committee meeting, I think it was last week, was a rabbi who got up and spoke very at length in support of the bill. And he was pointing to, you know, a lot of the anti-Semitic incidents that are happening and you know, concerns about those issues. That is the only one I've seen so far. You know, if the bill continues to move along in the House, we may see more of that. But at this point, he was the only one I've seen.
I'm talking with Jim Saunders from the News Service of Florida. A number of bills filed this legislative session expand where exactly we're allowed to bring concealed weapons. You can find more information about these bills and follow our legislative coverage at WLRN.org. Jim, another bill allows elected officials to bring weapons, concealed weapons, to meetings if, again, they have the concealed permit. Who's behind this legislation? What's the argument there?
Well, the argument is it would apply to the bill would apply to city, you know, city councils, county commissions, and school board members on the local level, and it would allow, as you said, the members of those commissions or boards to carry guns during their own meetings. You know, the argument is that that they are susceptible to some sorts of violence because of the decisions they make or during these meetings, that you know, some of these meetings can get pretty heated, and while you know, members of the audience are not supposed to carry guns into these meetings, it's possible that somebody would. So they are saying it's from a protection standpoint.
And are we this bill, but are we hearing from city and county leaders that they feel that threatened?
Well, you know, last week at a meeting, a county commissioner from Okaloosa County up here in the Panhandle got up and said that he felt threatened and that there was safety issues. You know, he was the only one I've heard so far. Just coincidentally, the sponsor of the bills for, is a House member from Okaloosa County who wants to run for the county commission out there. So, you know, but we haven't heard, I don't think there's been any broad movement from city and county officials from throughout the state. That bill passed another committee yesterday, and one interesting bit of debate went on was that it just kind of pointing out the differences geographically and experience-wise in the state. Representative Anna Escamani, who's from Orlando, a Democrat from Orlando, objected to the bill. And she said, you know, that she represents the area where Pulse Nightclub is. And she said, you know, we have quite a bit of different view in our neighborhood about guns as, you know, some of the folks in the Panhandle might. So, you know, I think that there is acknowledgement that, you know, Florida is a big state and, you know, very diverse a variety of views on these issues.
Right. Let me move over to the other bill, this one on gun show loopholes, this to create a database for private sales. Just real quickly, remind us of the gun show loophole, what that is.
Yeah, I mean, the gun show loophole has been an issue that's been around for a long time, both in Florida and other parts of the country, and it involves doing background checks on sales of guns at, you know, at these shows. You know, if you go into a gun shop and a licensed gun dealer and buy a weapon, you need a background check. It's trying to, you know, essentially take that to the gun show sort of venue. That's one of the interesting things is that the Senate, which also is, you know, controlled by Republicans, and it is pushing forward with those types of ideas, sort of gun control, and getting blowback from, you know, a lot of the some of their own members, some Republican senators, but also, you know, the NRA and some others are really coming after the Senate President Bill Galvano, who is a Republican, because he's supporting some of these types of measures. I tend to think in the end, you know, it's a kind of uphill climb to do something like closing the gun show loophole. Jose Oliva, the House Speaker, has already said he doesn't think it could get through the House. So I don't know whether any of this stuff is going to pass in the end before the legislative session ends in March. But it's sort of an interesting dichotomy right now between the House and the Senate, which are both Republican-controlled, and you know, in the past have been fairly amenable to the gun rights folks.
But as you've said, they're both going in different directions at the moment. Jim Saunders with the News Service of Florida joining us from Tallahassee. Jim, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
So, by the way, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Let us know, how would you feel about being able to carry a gun into a place of worship? Share your thoughts with us. Staying in Tallahassee, Governor Ron DeSantis recently proposed changes to Florida's education standards. Called the Benchmarks for Excellent Student Thinking, they would replace the Common Core standards that the state has been using since 2011. If passed, they will change how students approach math and English. They would also require all students to take courses in financial literacy and civics. Now, the State Board of Education is set to vote on the standards next week. Joining me now is our education reporter, Jessica Bakeman. Jessica, great to have you.
Thanks so much, Lewis.
How would you describe what Common Core standards were and how different the system was to what the governor's trying to propose now?
Right. Okay. So if we want to take a step back for a second, the Common Core was always intended to be a set of academic guidelines that would be used across the country. So the idea was to get a better sense of how students were performing nationwide, which was difficult to do when every state had their own set of standards and their own set of tests. Then it was really difficult to compare students from one state and another. The other idea behind the Common Core was to change what students learned in school so that they were getting more in depth. So instead of covering a lot of topics at the surface level, they would cover fewer topics, but in a lot more depth. And the focus was supposed to help students with critical thinking and problem solving, which are skills that are needed in college and careers.
And one of the criticisms I remember was, like, for example, math. And how kids were learning math.
Math has always been the big one because the way that Common Core taught math was so different than the way that parents had learned math when they were in school. And so parents would sit down to do homework with their kids and they would be really confused and not know how to get to, like, they could get to the answer, but they couldn't do the process the way that the Common Core wanted it to be done. And so there was a lot of pushback from that. But the pushback, the criticisms that happened with the Common Core early on, like in the 2010s, were not just because of concerns about the actual standards themselves, but concerns about how they came about and the politics behind it. So basically, Florida adopted the Common Core in 2010. It was around the same time that nearly every other state in the country adopted it. And that was partly because, of course, we were in the height of the Great Recession then. States really didn't have a lot of money to spend on schools. And so the Obama administration created this Race to the Top initiative. It was a competitive grant program that was offering hundreds of millions of dollars to states for education. But there were some catches. And one of the catches was you have to adopt career and college ready standards, which essentially was the Common Core. So then you have people saying it's not fair that the federal government is getting so deeply involved in what's happening in schools, which is really supposed to be something that happens on the local level. And of course, people who were already critics of Obama, you know, conservatives thought, sort of associated with him, and even called it Obama Core, kind of like Obamacare. So certainly some of those politics are coming into play with Ron DeSantis and what's happening in Florida now.
And the governor, he promised during his campaign he wanted to end it, and he's come out with the BEST standards. Okay, what is he changing with this?
Well, so, you know, they just recently, they've been going through this process. The governor's administration, the Department of Education, is led by Richard Corcoran, who's the former House Speaker. And they've been going through this process over pretty much most of last year, where they had different stakeholder groups like reviewing the previous standards, which were still based on the Common Core, although they were rebranded in 2014 to be called the Florida Standards because of those political reasons I mentioned. And so they had a lot of different people weighing in, and they've now put forward the new standards that are set to be adopted next week. Each one, the standards for English and the standards for math, are like 200 pages. So, you know, I haven't read all of them yet, and I'm certainly not an education expert to the point where I could pinpoint every single difference and every single change. But I know that one thing that they are hoping to do is to try to clear up some of those concerns around math and parents being able to work with students on their math homework.
Also teaching requiring civics, financial literacy as well. This wasn't part of the Common Core.
Right. So basically what the new standards include, a financial literacy component for high school, and they include some civics books in the ELA curriculum. The financial literacy component is interesting. It's something the legislature has been trying to push through for years, specifically former Senator Dorothy Huckel from Central Florida, who's really beloved in the legislature. She had a bill for years that would have required students to learn about financial literacy, and it kept stalling, in part because the legislature is very wary of putting new requirements on schools. They feel like if we put something new, then something else is going to have to go, and there's only so much time in the school day. Tragically, Senator Huckel died from cervical cancer in 2018, and then since then, there's been more of an urgency in the legislature to do something kind of in honor of her. And as far as civics, that, you know, to some extent, that goes back to some of the politics stuff, too. Like, I remember covering a meeting of the State University System's Board of Governors a couple years ago, and they were talking about some article they read that said, you know, a poll showed millennials, like, couldn't name the members of the Supreme Court, and that they were more open to socialism than some older generations. And the board felt that that was really disturbing and said clearly they don't know enough about civics. And so that has kind of been a part of the narrative that I think DeSantis is sort of grabbing onto there.
Another major change is to the standardized testing. One ninth grade English exam and a geometry exam will be phased out. But there are new requirements with the SAT and the ACT.
Right. So there's not a whole lot of detail yet, but basically what the Department of Education released so far says that within a few years, they would get rid of the high school English state test and the geometry test, and instead students would take the SAT and the ACT, which are college entrance exams, but they wouldn't be required to pass those tests for graduation. They would just have to take them. So this is really interesting. It's something we've seen across the country. There's a new federal law, fairly new in the last few years, called the Every Student Succeeds Act, which is actually like the rewrite of No Child Left Behind. And that expressly permits schools to use the SAT and ACT in lieu of state English and math tests. And in part, this is something that states are wanting to do because they think parents will be happier about it. They're like, okay, well, parents are mad because they think there's too much testing, but they like the SAT and the ACT because they know those brand names. It like makes sense to them. A lot of students will be taking those tests anyway if they're trying to go to college. And so if you eliminate the other tests, then it's like, okay, that's fewer tests that they're taking. And if you're a student who wasn't going to take those tests to begin with, now that might open a door to you for college, although there are certainly some criticisms about going that path as well.
I'm talking with WLRN's education reporter Jessica Bankman, again discussing the new education standards proposed by Governor Ron DeSantis to replace Common Core. You can read more about the BEST standards. Just go to WLRN.org. Jessica, in what ways could this impact school budgets? I mean, talking about just changing everything.
Right, absolutely. So it's important to know that what standards are is basically guidelines or benchmarks for here's what a student needs to learn in each grade, right? Like you need to read a Shakespeare play in high school. You need to learn how to divide fractions in fourth grade, you know. So those are really simple. And then what kind of the next layer is the curriculum. So that's like the lesson plans, the workbooks, the worksheets, the activities that students do in class that help them reach those standards. And then, of course, there's testing. So all of that infrastructure is based on the standards. And if you change the standards, you have to change the lesson plans. You have to change the textbooks. You have to change the tests. And all of that is really expensive. So as to school budgets themselves, I mean, those costs, some of them would be handled at the state level. But I think that you'll definitely see a conversation in the legislature about, well, if you're going to do all these changes, you need to give, you know, more money. You need to increase the funding to schools so that they can adapt.
Is it just for public schools or is this impacting charter schools, private schools?
So it's for all public schools, which includes charter schools. Charter schools are considered public schools. They're publicly funded but operated by private organizations. It would not affect private schools.
The as mentioned, the State Board of Education is set to vote on this next week. If they're approved, what happens next? I mean, is this something that's implemented for the next fall?
No, it's not happening immediately. They have a runway over the next few years to sort of phase this in. So the first thing is the governor has proposed $3 million in his state budget proposal for next fiscal year that would support teachers as they learn the new standards. So if that is approved by the legislature, then there would be teacher trainings in the new standards starting next school year. But the plan to update curriculum based on the new standards for English would be first and then math over the next few years and then the new state tests after that. So we're talking about between now and like 2023.
If parents wanted to learn more, I mean, they have access to those couple hundred pages?
Yeah, absolutely. They're posted on the Florida Department of Education webpage. There's a page titled Standards Review, which has not only those links to those standards themselves, but also a synopsis of the changes, comparisons of the new standards with other state standards, and like a bunch of PowerPoint presentations and other documents. So certainly if there are parents who want to know more, they can go directly to the source.
I know this. The governor made this announcement not that long ago, but just wondering if you've heard from anybody, teachers or anybody at the districts, about their feelings on that.
I think there's a lot of skepticism when any changes are made. I think that there probably are people on both sides of this issue, like people who didn't like the Common Core and are glad to see some changes. Like I mentioned, Commissioner Corcoran hosted town halls, like panels, to talk to people around the state, and I did cover one in Palm Beach County, and there, you know, there were some teachers who got up and said, we really didn't like the Common Core because we didn't think it was developmentally appropriate for students with disabilities, so they want to see some changes there. And, you know, there were some other people who got up and said, okay, well, we've seen this show before. Is anything really going to change? Is this really about the substance of changing what's happening in classrooms, or is it more about politics? And I don't think we have the answer to that just yet.
Well, it's available if you want to look at it and decide for yourself. Again, WLRN's education reporter Jessica Bakeman talking about this new proposal from the governor, the BEST standards. And again, it's available to you, so if you want to check it out. Jessica, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis.
And if you are a teacher or you work in education or you're a parent, find us on social media, WLRN Sundial. If you know anything about some of these changes proposed, let us know what you think about them. Well, still to come, how can we control pain without having to take a lot of addictive medication? That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Pain is a part of life, and it's actually necessary for survival. But chronic pain, that's something different. A CDC study from 2018 found 1 in 5 of us suffers from chronic pain. Over the past 2 decades, doctors have increasingly moved towards prescribing opioid medications to treat that chronic pain. And now the country's facing an epidemic, with 130 people dying daily from opioid overdoses. Scientists are researching how pain develops to come up with alternative treatments. National Geographic magazine chronicled this journey in their January issue. The story is by contributing writer Udijit Bhattacharjee. He joined us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Also with us for that conversation was Dr. Dennis Patton, pain management specialist at the University of Miami. What is chronic pain? I mean, what are the causes of it? How do you define it?
So chronic pain is pain that sort of has outlasted its utility as an alarm system for us, and is basically persistent and stays with us, you know, for weeks, months, beyond whatever injury it was or illness it was that triggered it. Now, not all chronic pain is triggered by injury, but chronic pain can also be the result of, you know, neurological disease. In some cases, it's the result of these pain-sensing neurons firing repeatedly without any reason to fire.
Pain is supposed to tell us there's a problem. It's a warning that there's a problem. But if we could have pain even if there's nothing there?
That's exactly right. And so not all chronic pain is like that, but there's many instances of chronic pain where there's no underlying, you know, illness that needs to be resolved. You know, the body is not really responding to tell you that there's a problem. It's more that the warning system, the pain sensing system itself, has gone awry. And in that sense, it's a neurological disorder.
Dr. Patton, what sorts of chronic pain do you tend to hear from patients? I'm wondering if there's like a specific type of issue that you hear most about, if it's a certain body part, or does it tend to happen after surgeries or an injury or something like that?
Most pain that we see in chronic pain clinics tends to be degenerative or traumatic. Degenerative associated with aging, low back pain, post-surgical pain syndromes, and post-traumatic. You get in a car accident, you might have pain for a long time after that accident. So it's really degenerative and or post-traumatic, with low back pain being the number one pain worldwide.
When a patient comes in and is talking about pain they've had for a period of time, what typically is the treatment plan?
Our treatment plan is broad and wide, ranging from non-invasive options such as acupuncture and physical therapy, progressing on through medical management with various classes of drugs, interventional treatments with different types of injections from the body wall to deep in the nervous system, and then finally to what we call neuromodulation, where we use electrical or chemical drugs at the spinal cord level to treat pain.
Mr. Bhattacharjee, I wanted to ask you, how has scientists' understanding of pain perception changed over time? Are we putting enough emphasis on understanding pain?
Pain has been with us forever, and studies of pain have also been done for a long time. But it's really been in the last, I would say, 20, 25 years that pain has received renewed attention. And in fact, we're right now, you know, giving it so much attention because of the opioid crisis, which has devastated lots of communities around the United States. So to answer your question about how our understanding of pain has advanced over the years, basically pain is sensed by these pain-sensing neurons, and those neurons send pain signals up to the spinal cord from where it travels to the brain. So it's really in the details of that pathway and process that scientists have made some pretty huge leaps in working out the fine details of exactly how the pain sensing occurs, how these signals are transmitted, and then finally, how the perception of pain is put together in the brain. Because even though you might think that pain is produced at the site of injury, but really the experience of pain is produced inside the head, like every other experience we have.
With the opioid issue, I mean, right now what we're learning is that pharma knew its addictiveness and was pushing that product. But I want to talk about doctors in general, because I want to know what doctors know about pain. What do doctors know about chronic pain? Because, I mean, they are the ones signing off on these prescriptions, but how much do they think about pain itself and not the cause of it?
Very, very little. There's too much attention on the cause without the concern of the treatment. And what I mean by the cause, what's happened to the body. And that's a disservice to patients when they can't find out what is wrong with the body, yet the patient still has pain. And you don't even have to have the body part anymore to have pain. And phantom limb, after an amputation, phantom limb pain syndrome is a great example of how you don't have to have the body part or anything wrong with the body to have pain. But back to your question about the training, historically, there's been no training in medical school about pain, other than what a physician would learn or a medical student would learn in the course of their training, such as what opioid to prescribe after a surgical procedure. That's about it. But recently, curricula are being changed and amended to include lectures on chronic pain. In fact, that's what we do here at the university. So it's becoming more and more popular. But even if you're exposed to it and learn it, that doesn't mean you have the tools to recognize it and deal with it. So I'm always been a proponent that people with chronic pain need to be referred to chronic pain specialists who understand pain and have all the tools to deal with it and treat it.
I'm talking with Udijit Bhattacharjee. He's a contributing writer to National Geographic magazine. His latest story is called A World of Pain. It looks at research into pain management and how scientists are coming up with ways to alleviate chronic pain. We're also joined by Dr. Dennis Patton. He's a pain management specialist at the University of Miami. Mr. Bhattacharjee, I wanted to ask you about this. You mentioned it earlier. In our scientifically how we're understanding the way pain is processed in the body. And I wanted to ask you straight up, is it just a state of mind? I mean, is it just a matter of shutting off a part of my brain and I can just ignore the pain?
Well, no, because, you know, pain is real in the sense that these are real, you know, physiological signals that are coursing through our neurons up into our brain. But the brain isn't a mute kind of receiver of pain, a receiver and analyst of pain, if you will. It's also participating. You know, it's unleashing its own biochemicals as sort of a feedback to this process. It's some of the biochemicals that are unleashed will tamp down the pain experience. And so, by changing the state of the mind, researchers have shown that scientifically you can alter the pain experience and you can lessen the pain if you kind of lessen the pain expectation.
And that was part of the story, the interesting aspect of how there were people who were basically listening to certain types of music or doing, they were even trying virtual reality. And it was helping in manage the pain. So basically, are you basically saying that distracting the mind, you can avoid pain?
Yes, you're absolutely right. Researchers have shown that when people are sad or depressed, they tend to feel pain more intensely. And again, that's a broad term because, you know, there's different aspects or facets of pain. There's the emotional distress that pain causes. There's the physical sort of just the core hurting aspect of pain. And so those are kind of distinguished, you know, when you start really getting down deep into what the pain experience is.
You actually did the virtual reality.
Yeah, I did. And it was quite surprising because just like you, you know, I was surprised that pain could be altered by your mood or by manipulating the mind, but I experienced it firsthand.
First of all, what did you see, but what was happening in that experience and how was it affecting you?
So this was me willingly being subjected or subjecting myself to pain, but only a very little amount of pain. So I sat down in the sofa at the University of Maryland, Baltimore, inside a lab, and the researchers put a little patch on my skin that was equipped to deliver these heat pulses onto my skin. Not so hot and not so long that it would burn my skin, but just enough for me to feel it. And so first, you know, I just sat there, and then I felt these pulses. And they took recordings of the temperature that I was able to tolerate. And then I put on these virtual reality goggles and watched this video of life under the ocean. And it was just, these beautiful jellyfish and other sea creatures floating about me. It was very realistic, as many virtual reality experiences are. And I was sort of lost in this submarine world, while the researchers continued to dose me with heat pulses and record the temperature at which I said, "Please, you know, no more." And the temperature that I was able to tolerate was nearly 2 degrees higher when I was wearing the virtual reality goggles than when I wasn't. So that was kind of a simple demonstration of the mind kind of, you know, increasing my pain tolerance because of the circumstances in which I was feeling the pain.
That was National Geographic contributing writer Udijit Bhattacharjee and Dr. Dennis Patton, pain management specialist at the University of Miami. You can read Bhattacharjee's story by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, the Cuban family dynamic comes to life in a new show on Miami Beach. It's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Family. It's a word that means different things to everyone. A connection, comfort, love, friendship, gatherings, sometimes annoyance. At a play at the Colony Theater of Miami Beach, you're thrown into the kitchen of a Cuban family preparing for a celebratory dinner. There's frijoles and arroz. They speak Spanglish to each other, and it seems like a normal night until someone doesn't come home for dinner. Throughout the play, you experience the complexities of this Cuban family and the generational divide that raises points of tension between the children and their parents. The lead actress is Ashley Alvarez. She plays the character of Christy. Ashley is from Miami and received her BFA from Florida International University. And she joined us last week to talk about the production. The Cubans is running at the Colony Theater on Lincoln Road until February 16th. You can read a review on WLRN.org or on our social media at WLRN Sundial.
This is a story of a Cuban-American family. Two parents, Dika and Jesus. The older daughter is Christy, who is an actress that has been living in New York for 9 years, trying to achieve her dreams. Her younger brother, Mati, has just graduated from UF. So the play begins and we're celebrating his graduation party. But I think what's really beautiful about this family is that there's also the extended family that aren't related by blood, but we call them family. So growing up, I had tías and tíos that weren't actually my aunts and uncles. So we have family friends that are also gathering for the graduation party. We have aunts, uncles, we have cousins. So it's just this wonderful celebration of a bunch of Cubans in one room. And in theater and in many mediums, things can either be categorized as a comedy or a drama. I really do believe that this play encompasses both because life is complicated. And there are very dramatic moments in the play. A monumental event happens at the end of Act One. And so much of this play is the way that the family uses humor to cover the hurt that we're feeling.
This was written by your husband. He's Cuban-American. You're mm-hmm. Cuban-American. Is this family the quintessential Cuban-American family?
I think so. I think we capture the nuances of our culture, the food, the music, the way we talk very quickly, the color in our voices, in our costumes, in our personalities, but also the hurt that is there. But with that being said, I do think that this is a very universal story.
And how do you define that? How do you define what that Cuban-American family, the Cuban-American experience is?
For me, it's a lot deeper than the stereotype. I think right now when we think Cuban-American family, we think of dancing to the conga and eating croquetas, which is definitely a part of what we are. But I do think that what defines us is we are a group of people who left a country that we weren't ready to leave. And we were forced to leave and we had to restart and try to achieve the American dream here. And I think that what my husband captures so beautifully in this play is that we haven't really let go of the past that's there. And so many Cubans, I think, are still waiting that they can go back to their homeland and bring their kids, bring their grandkids. And we're kind of left in limbo. So that, to me, is what's quintessential about a Cuban-American family, is that we are immigrants who aren't really allowed to talk about our past because I think it brings up too much pain.
And this idea of going back home, that's also part of the play.
Definitely, except we can't go back home. So what happens when you can't go back to your roots? What does that mean for the next generation? I've never been able to go see Cuba. I think it would be too painful for my family. My husband's been twice, and it was just to see his family in those conditions. So I always envy my Puerto Rican friends or Dominican friends that are able to go back and see where their family was raised, and we don't have that connection. And I think that that's been passed down. I think that's kind of in my genes without my family maybe acknowledging it.
You play the part of Christy. Who is she?
Christy is a 30-year-old first-generation American who is very much trying to make her parents proud. With that being said, I think she's very misunderstood. So I think she has had dreams from of being an actress from when she was a little girl, but her mom very much wants her to be a doctor or a lawyer and have a stable career and be married and have kids, and she doesn't have any of those things. So I think she's at a crucial turning point where she doesn't know how to justify everything her parents sacrificed. She feels this immense pressure of, my parents left everything behind to give me this wonderful opportunity, and I'm not really making them proud with it. So she's at this very vulnerable moment in her life.
How much is she like you?
She's like me in a lot of ways. The dating stuff, no, because I've been with my husband for 15 years. So I've been very lucky to not struggle with that. There's a big joke about Tinder, and I'm like, I've never been on Tinder. So that I don't relate to. But you know what? My mom, for most of my life, my mom is a dancer, but most of my life was like, you have to be a lawyer. You have to be a lawyer. I'm like, Mom, but you're in the arts. I love the arts. Isn't that what I should be following? So that notion of how do we make sure that our parents, what they sacrificed was all worth it? That, I think, is always playing underneath for me in my real life.
Is there any one part of the show that you can point to and you say that just an action or something that Christy does that resonates with you as a Latina?
I would say definitely her opening monologue. Her opening monologue is all about her going on auditions and people trying to define what she is. She has very light-colored skin. She has good grammar. This is the way that she talks. This is the way she represents herself. That isn't Latina enough. And growing up in Miami, I was a majority, so I never had to define that. I was like, oh, I'm Cuban. I'm Latina. That's how I am. Then I moved to Chicago, and people were like, where are you from? I love that accent. I'm like, I don't have an accent. I'm American. What are you talking about? And then moving to New York, I realized, you know what? Like, I think I do have this internal identity crisis of I'm not really sure what people get when they see me. I'm not sure what I put out there, but I'm learning to realize that that's okay. I don't have to prove my Latinidad to anybody. I am Latina.
I'm speaking with Ashley Alvarez. She's from Miami. She received her BFA from Florida International University. She plays the role of Christy in the play called The Cubans. That play is running at the Colony Theater on Lincoln Road until February 16th. Find out more on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Let's talk about that opening scene. Christy is talking to her mom about life in New York as an actress, and you got a little monologue for us so we get a taste of it.
Mommy, can you believe it? He has the audacity to tell me that croquetas are not really Cuban, but actually Miami Cuban, whatever that means. Like, he equated it to American Chinese food. You know, like, it's not really Chinese food, but it's more an American version of Chinese food. I mean, seriously, who does he think he is? He goes to Cuba for 3 days, watches some documentary on Netflix, and all of a sudden, he's an expert on all Cuban culture and cuisine. Wait till I tell Papi, he is going to flip out. Wait. I haven't even told you the best part. He then goes on to tell me that I'm not really Cuban. That's right. Since I was born here, I'm not actually Cuban. I'm American. I mean, really. Yes, I get it. I'm Cuban-American. But why can't I say that I'm Cuban? I grew up speaking Spanish. I grew up with Cuban history and culture. In my eyes, that makes me Cuban. You know, I go to these auditions, and they say, looking for Latina, 25-30, tough, fiery, sexy. And I'll get to the sexy part in a second. But I show up, and they're like, oh, you're so white. We're going for a more Latino look. What does a Latino even look like? Papi is half Chinese. And then I go on audition for a white character and they're like, what's your accent? Girl, I don't have an accent. Okay, seriously, I don't have an accent. I mean, maybe I talk quickly or maybe it's a Miami thing, but that's not the point. The point is, where do I fit in?
What's Christy talking about here in this scene?
I think she's really trying to get her mom to tell her that she is Cuban enough. That she is Latina enough. I think she's at a point in her life where the world is telling her, because of the way she looks, because of the way she represents herself, she's a white American, which is something that I very much identify with. Even within the Latino community, I feel like I'm not Latina enough for my fellow Latinos. And I think she's hoping that her mom's going to be like, of course you're Cuban. And since I did it as a monologue, you couldn't hear the mom's line, but the mom says, no, you're American. So I think that this is just the perfect jumpstart for the play because it really examines where she is in that identity crisis.
And as you said, there's this tension because she has expectations for you. You didn't meet. You
exactly.
haven't met. Is that a Latino thing? Do you think that's a Latino thing? That's an immigrant thing.
I think it's very much an immigrant thing. I remember when I was younger, I was always surprised that a lot of my white friends would go away to college because it was always just understood that I would stay in Miami for college or, you know, my grandmother would live with us when she was getting older. These qualities of you feeling the pressure that you want to return the favor to your parents and your grandparents. And I think as an artist, you don't feel like you've measured up. And I don't have a 401k. I don't have properties. I don't have a house that I can buy my mom. And those are things that's all I want. So you really question that and you feel like you're not the ideal child.
As you said, that this whole play, the whole story is about a big celebration. It's your brother's graduation. So mm-hmm. now everybody's coming to, you know, to have this big party, this big gathering. One of the points of tension is the generational divide mm-hmm. between the family members, ideologically, politically, et cetera. How are these divides resonating with audiences right now? What have you been hearing?
So we have this great moment in the play where we talk about the embargo. And it's amazing because the second we mention it, the entire audience, you can hear the gasps. And we usually hold it for about 2 to 3 minutes of laughter, which is a mixture of genuine laughter and then awkward laughter. And my character suggests that the embargo isn't working, much to the disapproval of all of her older generation parents, aunts, uncles. But I do think that these are conversations that need to be had because, like I think I mentioned to you earlier, there are so many stories that our parents didn't share with us, so we don't know the specifics. So a lot of my Cuban history I've gotten from books or documentaries, not from my family who lived it. And I think I have come to form my own opinion, and I want to make sure that I can have these conversations as opposed to just blindly follow what my parents have told me to follow.
Families will come to this country to let go of the past. They want you, the next generation, to move forward. And yet you, that generation, is trying to get reconnected to that past.
Yeah.
And it's throughout the play, but that, again, is the immigrant story,
mm-hmm.
right? And so for you personally, because you're as a Cuban American, do you feel more American than you do Cuban?
I do, because I think my whole life, my mom and my dad and my grandparents were, make sure you learn perfect English, your grammar, the way you present yourself, because that's what we do. We assimilate in this country. They don't want us to feel like another. So the more that we can blend in, the easier it's going to be for us. Now, I think what they didn't anticipate is that that's why we have a hole missing in terms of our identity, because we don't really know where we came from. And we're not having these conversations to understand. I've recently gotten a lot closer to my grandmother, and I've learned that she had a brother. She has a brother who's still in Cuba, a brother who passed away. These are things that I didn't know about her my whole life. I just thought she was this really strong, tough woman. And to see these vulnerabilities, I was like, oh, well, that means I can be vulnerable too. And I think it is so important that we share these stories. If you don't share them, then we get them from the outside world. And those are the inaccurate stories. So I do think that that is a huge, huge part of this play. I know that is why my husband started writing this play, was coming from that void of wanting to learn more about these stories.
That was Ashley Alvarez. She's from Miami. She received her BFA from Florida International University, and she plays the role of Christy in the play called The Cubans. The play is running at the Colony Theater on Lincoln Road until February 16th. And that's Sundaw for this Tuesday, February 4th. Coming up tomorrow on Sundaw, we're going to sit down with Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez in his final year in office. We'll discuss his priorities for this final year, his newly launched campaign for Congress, and his take on Miami hosting future Super Bowls. Plus, former NPR host Diane Rehm is out with a new book, When My Time Comes. It's a series of interviews with doctors, patients, advocates, and critics of access to end-of-life drugs. She'll be in Miami on Thursday. And if in case you missed it, this month we are going to be reading Cattail, The Wild Weird Battle to Save the Florida Panther. It's by reporter and author Craig Pittman. Join us on Saturday, by the way, February 8th at a live event with Craig. We're going to be at Books and Books in Coral Gables. You can find more on our website, WLRN.org. Love to see you there. By the way, don't forget, join our book club. Find us on Facebook. Look up Sundial Book Club. Ask to join. It's free. Let us know what you think of the book. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Remember, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We'll talk to you tomorrow.